This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. So, maybe you've heard about the White House Correspondents Association dinner last weekend, where my guest, comic Michelle Wolfe, was the performer. Some of the attendees found some of her jokes inappropriate, especially a couple of jokes about White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders. Sanders, who was seated at the dais representing the Trump administration, was not laughing. Wolf's performance became the subject of ongoing analysis and debate on cable news and Twitter and websites. A lot of journalists are now saying the dinner should no longer include a guest comic. The White House Correspondents Association president said Wolf's performance was not in the spirit of the event's mission of offering a unifying message about the group's commitment to a free press while honoring civility, not dividing people. We're going to talk about what this whole episode has been like for Wolf. Wolf is known for doing comedy from a feminist perspective. She's been a writer and performer on Late Night with Seth Meyers and a correspondent on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. Last year, she had an HBO comedy special called Nice Lady. And she has a new weekly Netflix comedy series called The Break that will debut May 27th. To put this controversy in perspective, the White House Correspondents Association dinner has for many years concluded with the president doing stand-up, roasting the media and politicians, followed by a guest comic roasting the president, politicians, and the media. This year and last year, President Trump decided not to attend and instead counter-programmed with rallies, giving speeches to cheering fans. Let's hear some excerpts of Michelle Wolf's set Saturday night, with some of the jokes that went over well in the room. We'll hear the Sarah Sanders part a little later.
Good evening. Here we are, the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Like a porn star says when she's about to have sex with a Trump, let's get this over with. And just a reminder to everyone, I'm here to make jokes. I have no agenda. I'm not trying to get anything accomplished. So everyone that's here from Congress, you should feel right at home. And I know as much as some of you might want me to, it's 2018 and I'm a woman, so you cannot shut me up. Unless you have Michael Cohen wire me $130,000. It is kind of crazy that the Trump campaign was in contact with Russia when the Hillary campaign wasn't even in contact with Michigan.
It's a direct flight. It's so close.
Of course, Trump isn't here, if you haven't noticed. He's not here. And I know I would drag him here myself, but it turns out the President of the United States is the one you're not allowed to grab.
He said it first.
Yeah, he did. You remember? Good.
We're going to try a fun new thing, okay? I'm going to say Trump is so broke, and you guys go, how broke is he? All right? Trump is so broke. He had to borrow money from the Russians, and now he's compromised and not susceptible to blackmail and possibly responsible for the collapse of the Republic. Yay! It's a fun game. Trump's also an idea guy. He's got loads of ideas. You gotta love him for that. He wants to give teachers guns. And I support that, because then they can sell them for things they need, like supplies. Democrats are harder to make fun of because you guys don't do anything. People think you might flip the House and Senate this November, but you guys always find a way to mess it up. You're somehow gonna lose by 12 points to a guy named Jeff Pedophile Nazi Doctor. Fox News is here, so you know what that means, ladies. Cover your drinks. Seriously. People want me to make fun of Sean Hannity tonight, but I cannot do that. This dinner's for journalists. Good night. Clint still doesn't have clean water.
Michelle Wolf, welcome to Fresh Air. I don't know what to say. What was your weekend like? But kind of like I think you managed to end the long tradition of having a comic at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
I think you broke the dinner.
Are you surprised at the level of controversy that your routine at the dinner has created.
I wasn't expecting this level, but I'm also not, you know, I'm not disappointed there's this level. I knew what I was doing going in. I wanted to do something different. I didn't want to cater to the room. I wanted to cater to the outside audience and not betray my brand of comedy. My friend of mine who helped me write he gave me a note before I went on, which I kept with me, which was, be true to yourself, never apologize, burn it to the ground.
When you say you didn't want to cater to the room, you didn't want to betray who you are as a comic, what would it have meant to cater to the room, and how would that have betrayed who you are as a comic?
I think a lot of it, and what I've seen in the past, is just like, you know, they poke little fun at, you know, they'll go like kind of table by table, being like pointing at people and making fun of them in a way that I think used to be fun, because the dinner used to have the president there. It used to be a like fun. We're all poking fun of each other. The president's going to poke fun of us. We're going to hit back. Now it seems like it's a much more serious environment, and to kind of not go after the big issues and just like have a little fun in the room seemed just not as exciting to me.
Well, you know, the way dinner has worked in the past is that a comic basically roasts the press, the president, Congress, and whoever else the comic wants to address, you know, wants to roast, relevant to the, you know, to the press in the room. But then the president gets to roast whoever the president wants, the media, Congress, and whoever. But with President Trump having opted out this year and last year, it's become very asymmetrical, because the comic gets to roast and there's no comeback from the president. So how did you weigh that into, if at all, your writing and your performance, you know, the asymmetricality of it without the president there?
I didn't really weigh it in. I also wasn't, normally the president goes right before the comic. And I wasn't even sure until like the day before if Sarah was going to speak or not. But I had already written everything I was going to write. So I was just going off of that.
By Sarah, you mean Sarah Sanders?
Sarah Sanders, yeah.
Yeah. Because the spirit of the White House Correspondents' Dinner has always been like a roast, or at least in the past few years, that's what the spirit has been. Had you ever participated in a roast before?
I've written roast jokes for people, but I've never done... Well, I've judged a couple roasts at comedy clubs.
Did you go in with thinking, like, this is a roast?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I went in thinking, you know, we're roasting people. People are going to get made fun of. And the overarching thing that people kept telling me is that they were like, it's a bad room. And that it just, like, they were like, nothing ever sounds good in that room. It's a large ballroom. The audience isn't mic'd, so you can't, the laughs aren't very audible in general. But it's also... It's formal, which people don't laugh as much when they're dressed up. There's round tables and people are eating or drinking. So by the virtue of a round table, people are partially turned away from you. And it's televised. And there are all these people that may or may not be able to show genuine reactions. And so if you're constantly thinking, I need to react in a way that is... will come off well on TV.
You mean like not seem partisan?
Right, yeah. that you might not be giving a genuine reaction to what's being said.
You're saying some people might be afraid to laugh because it'll make them look partisan?
Make them look partisan, or make them like look like they're laughing at someone they shouldn't be laughing at.
Right.
So when I was, you know, when I was writing the jokes and I was working on this, like I wasn't expecting it to go over well in the room.
So during part of your routine, the camera, when you were talking about Sarah Sanders, the camera was on her part of the time. She didn't look happy at all. Did you think about the camera being on her while you were telling the jokes? Because like if you're in a stand-up club and you're doing comedy and you're making a joke about somebody in the Trump administration, the camera isn't going to be on them when you're telling the joke. They're not going to be in the room. So this is different.
Yeah, it is different. But, you know, there's plenty where you could look back, and the camera was on Obama when people were making pretty aggressive jokes about Obama, and he was laughing. And I think having the ability to laugh at yourself is important. I also think that if you, another part of the dinner that wasn't televised is they were giving out awards, and everyone was standing to congratulate the people that were getting awards, and Sarah was sitting.
So you think she was kind of like sitting in protest? Because
yes.
These are media awards, and she didn't want to stand in praise of the media?
Correct.
Was there something specifically said about CNN that she didn't stand?
Yeah, the CNN reporters got awards. I cannot remember the exact award they got, but they came up to accept them, and she sat the whole time while we all stood and shook their hands. But I would say if you know, this was about celebrating the media, she wasn't there to celebrate the media.
You had several jokes that were controversial about abortion, about the media. You said something about Kellyanne Conway that I expected to cause more controversy than it actually caused. As we record early in the morning on Monday, the most controversial joke has been about Sarah Sanders. So I want to play what you said about Sarah Sanders.
We are graced with Sarah's presence tonight. I have to say, I'm a little starstruck. I love you as Aunt Lydia in The Handmaid's Tale. Mike Pence, if you haven't seen it, you would love it. Every time Sarah steps up to the podium, I get excited because I'm not really sure what we're gonna get. You know, a press briefing, a bunch of lies, or divided into softball teams. It's shirts and skins, and this time don't be such a little bitch, Jim Acosta. I actually really like Sarah. I think she's very resourceful. Like, she burns facts. And then she uses that ash to create a perfect smoky eye. Like, maybe she's born with it. Maybe it's lies. It's probably lies.
So it was Michelle Wolf, Saturday night at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. So a lot of people thought that you were attacking Sarah Sanders for her looks. I don't really like to put you in the position of having to dissect your joke, but I'm going to ask you to do it anyways. What was your intention for the joke?
I think people have a lot of preconceived notions about Sarah's looks. I think a lot of what's happening is they're projecting onto this joke. I made a conscious effort not to write any jokes about any woman's looks in this speech. I think it's clear that the joke wasn't about Sarah's looks, but I don't think, it's so obvious that I don't even really need to defend it. I think if you listen to the joke, you'll understand that it's about the fact that she lies. And if it's taken another way, I think you should go back and listen to it again.
So when you mention her eyeliner, are you criticizing her eyeliner? And if so, is criticizing her eyeliner different than criticizing how she looks?
I said she had a perfect smoky eye, so I was complimenting her eyeliner. Because it's fine. Her makeup's fine. It's the fact that she burns facts and she uses lies for her smoky eye.
So you also compared her to the Aunt Lydia character on A Handmaid's Tale. And for any listeners who don't watch A Handmaid's Tale, and imagine there's a lot of people who don't watch it, would you describe the character of Aunt Lydia? And Aunt Lydia is played by Ann Dowd.
Yeah, the character of Aunt Lydia is kind of the mouthpiece for the administration in The Handmaid's Tale. She's the woman that kind of is in charge of all the handmaids and is kind of like the sergeant, so to speak. And she's the one that enforces all the rules.
And the rules have to do with women have to be trained to serve, to be handmaids, and to be fertile and carry, be pregnant as often as possible, because that is their role.
Yeah, the role of handmaids in The Handmaid's Tale is essentially like pregnancy slaves, I guess. I don't know a better word for it, where they're just supposed to produce and have babies against their will, essentially. And I was commenting on how her actions for the Trump administration are similar to Aunt Lydia's in The Handmaid's Tale. She communicates from the president just like Aunt Lydia communicates the objectives of the society.
So some people think that that part was also insulting to Sarah Sanders' looks. And in some ways, if you were insulting her looks by comparing her to Ann Dowd, would you be insulting Ann Dowd as well?
Yeah, which is very unfair. Ann Dowd's gorgeous. and she's a very talented actress, which I think is more important. I think to look at that and say I was insulting Sarah's looks, you had to want me to be insulting Sarah's looks. I mean, it's like, I was talking about her personality, and I think it says a lot about our society that you would immediately think I was talking about her looks rather than her personality. Because I think if it was a man, you wouldn't have jumped to those conclusions. If I was talking about a man, you would have been like, she's talking about his abilities. But because I was talking about a woman, you're like, she's talking about her looks.
So you're in the position now of being a feminist comic, getting criticized by other women, including some very powerful, incredibly smart women, for doing something sexist, for criticizing a woman for her looks. And you say, like, no, that's not what I did. Listen more carefully. But how does it feel to be a feminist being, you know, criticized by other women in addition to a lot of men who are criticizing you as well?
I mean, isn't that sort of what we do as women? Unfortunately.
I'd say that the women see themselves as standing up for another woman. They're standing up for, I think they see themselves as defending Sarah Sanders against a careless or, you know, inappropriate joke.
I mean, I think they should listen to the joke again because it's clearly not about her appearance.
I'm wondering if you think it's maybe a little bit sexist to think that Sarah Sanders as a woman needs to be protected from a couple of jokes at a roast, because I haven't heard men be protected that way at roasts.
Yeah, I mean, if there was two people that I actually made fun of their looks on Saturday, it was Mitch McConnell and Chris Christie. and no one is jumping to their defense. I made fun of Mitch McConnell's neck, and I did a small jab at Chris Christie's weight. No one is jumping to their defense.
After one of your jokes about the Women's March and the, I can't say the word, the pea hats that women wore, and then you made a joke about female genitalia, you said, and I quote, "You should have done more research before you got me to do this." I got the impression you really meant that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know, maybe I'm projecting this, but I think sometimes they look at a woman and they think, oh, she'll be nice. And if you've seen any of my comedy, you know that I'm not. I don't pull punches. I'm not afraid to talk about things. And, you know, I don't think they expected that from me. I think they still have preconceived notions of how women will present themselves. And I don't fit in that box.
Do you have any regrets about having done the dinner?
I'm honestly, I wouldn't change a single word that I said. I'm very happy with what I said. And I'm glad I stuck to my guns.
Michelle, I want to play a clip from your recent HBO special, Nice Lady. And this is about not wanting to be married or have a child.
I don't want to have a baby or a family. I want a career. That's what I want. And I know there's a lot of people out there that are like, but Michelle, you don't have to choose. You can have it all. Women can have it all. Yeah, stop saying that. You act like all is good. All does not mean good. You've never left an all-you-can-eat buffet and thought, I feel really good about myself. That crab and pudding is sitting really well together. I sure am glad I went back for spare ribs. All is not good. And even if we do try to have it all, even if a woman out there definitely wants it all, we've put up too many obstacles in your way to make it possible. It's like, oh, congratulations, you're having a baby? Great, couple things. We're gonna need you to get that car accident of a body back to work as soon as possible because this is America and we don't think you need time to recover. Also, you should breastfeed. It's what's best for the baby. But don't do it in public, you pig. Do it in the old janitor's closet underneath the bridge with the rest of the breastfeeding trolls. And don't have to take time off from work when your kids are sick. We'll think you're not dedicated. Also, why are you such a bad mom? By the way, your salary is just enough to cover the cost of childcare. And we know you're exhausted. You don't really know who you are anymore. You're trying to balance your old life and your new life. But quick, go have sex with your husband. He's about to leave. He doesn't understand what you're going through. Quick, go now! And sweetie, smile!
That's Michelle Wolf from her recent HBO comedy special, Nice Lady. So I think you're serious about not wanting to have a baby or be in a relationship. Do some people think there's something wrong with you when you say that?
I mean, yes, but I don't know. I'm just different than what people, I think, want me to be or want a woman to be.
So I want to play another excerpt of your recent comedy special on HBO called Nice Lady. And this is a part in which you're talking about Hillary Clinton. And you say that you voted for her, but you understand why some people don't like her.
Mm-hmm.
And so here you are on your comedy special.
I get not liking Hillary, but the one thing that I think is completely unforgivable is some people would be like, well, you know what it is? I just can't listen to her. She has such a shrill voice. And it's like, well, sometimes. That's just what happens to your voice. Sometimes you're a person with a shrill voice, and there's nothing you can do about it. Because you don't get to choose your voice. That causes dogs to gather outside. No, I want it to be so shrill that if I sucked the helium out of a balloon, it wouldn't change my voice at all. That might be 100% real thing that happened to me.
Okay, so that's Michelle Wolf from her HBO comedy special, Nice Lady. Let's talk about your voice. I was unsure how you'd sound as yourself, not on stage, but just like talking to me. And I'd say your voice sounds, you know, sounds a little different when you're just talking to me. Does your voice change on stage naturally? Do you emphasize certain qualities in it when you're on stage?
Well, I also know how nice your voice is, so I'm making an effort this morning to keep it at a tone that's not offensive.
Oh, are you kidding? No. I don't even know how to take it.
You have such a soothing voice, and I didn't. I was like, just Michelle, just keep it down.
No, be yourself. Be you. Whatever you are, be you.
I think I'm just louder on stage, and when I get louder, it gets shriller.
My voice gets higher when I try to get louder. I let go.
Mine does. Yeah, it does. It's the same time the volume goes up, that the shrillness goes up. I don't know. I love my voice. I think it's great. I'm happy to make fun of it because I know it is a bit silly. I also, for some reason, when I'm on stage, I can sound very Midwestern. Which I'm not. I'm from central Pennsylvania. I just think it being on stage kind of amplifies little quirks in my voice that aren't necessarily in my like day-to-day conversation.
So you used to be a contributor on The Daily Show. And I want to play a clip from one of your appearances on The Daily Show. And you were at the desk with Trevor Noah on this. This is from May 8th, 2017, and you're talking about an all-male Senate Republican working group to find a consensus on health care. It was all male and all white. And as this excerpt starts, we're seeing on the screen a photo of all the men in this group. So this is Michelle Wolf with Trevor Noah on The Daily Show.
Seriously, look at the senators who we're trusting with health care. That doesn't look like the panel that protects women. That looks like the panel that says, well, she drowned, guess she wasn't a witch. Throw in another one. 13 white guys and no women. 13 white guys and no women. In that group, they were able to get two Mormons, but no women. Which is weird for Mormons, because normally they want extra women. I mean, you'd think they'd at least put Mike Pence in that group so his wife would have to be there, too.
Well, to be fair, Michelle, just because this bill is being worked on by only men doesn't mean that they can't be fair to women.
Oh, sure. I mean, they could be fair to us, but this is what they've done so far.
The bill in its current form would hit women especially hard. For example, women who are pregnant, have had a previous C-section, have irregular periods, have breast cancer, and endometriosis, among others, could all be slapped with the pre-existing condition label, opening up the door for insurers to potentially deem them uninsurable.
I'm sorry, you'd have to pay extra for insurance if you get irregular periods? Okay. Quick glimpse into a lady's life. Every period is an irregular period. It's not like a paycheck where it arrives on the same day every month. Your period is more like an outdoor cat. You know it's gonna come back at some point, but you're never positive when, and you have no idea what it's gonna have in its mouth.
That's Michelle Wolf on The Daily Show 1 year ago. You've done a lot of humor about what men don't understand about women's bodies. How did you start using that as a topic for humor?
I just think it's so laughable, the fact that there's these things that happen to women constantly on a day-to-day basis that we just don't talk about because men think they're icky. You know, like, I mean, periods are a thing that women are dealing with all of the time, not just when they have their period. It's days throughout their cycle, weeks before. You know, we all have different symptoms. We all go through different things. Everyone gets, not everyone, but people get different varying versions of PMS and, you know, when your skin breaks out, you know, all that stuff. And we just don't talk about it. And it's something that we're constantly living with. And I think part of the reason we don't talk about it is because we want to protect men from having to hear about it. And I'm just so sick of it.
So, you know, your HBO comedy special is called Nice Lady. Did you ever want to just be nice? Because you talk about how, like, you're not nice. And Hillary Clinton isn't nice. And no woman who has power is, like, nice. And if they think they're nice, they're just kidding themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I do think for the longest time, you know, I did want to be nice. I thought that's how I was supposed to be. I thought I was just supposed to be nice and pleasant. And then I realized that's no fun.
Well, Michelle Wolf, thank you so much for coming. I know this is like a really crazy period for you. Thank you so much for taking the time to come to our show and to be willing to talk about the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Michelle Wolf's new Netflix weekly comedy series, The Break, premieres May 27th. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Alex Wagner's professional identity is journalist. She's a contributor to CBS News and The Atlantic Magazine, a reporter on the Showtime political documentary series The Circus, and a former MSNBC anchor. Her personal identity, well, that was always a bit confusing for her because she has an improbable family tree. Her mother and grandmother fled a military dictatorship in Burma, immigrating to the U.S. in 1965. Her father is American. His family's roots are in Ireland and Luxembourg. Her mother is Buddhist, her father Catholic. Wagner wanted a sense of belonging to a group that she didn't have, and she says that made her identity hungry and identity fatigued. In her new book, Future Face, she writes about trying to understand her identity by researching her ancestry, traveling to Burma and Luxembourg, searching through archives, and doing DNA ancestry tests of herself, her parents, and her grandmother. One of the questions she ended up investigating is, how accurate are these DNA ancestry tests? Alex Wagner, welcome to Fresh Air. It is a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, it is a pleasure and an honor. Thank you so much, Terry.
So you write in your book that you were taught that your ancestors shouldn't affect your destiny. What were the ways in which you were given that message by your parents or your grandmother?
Well, I think as Americans, we're taught this idea, go west, young man. Don't worry about everything you're leaving behind. That's sort of part of the American ethic, is to not to worry too much about the past and that it shouldn't define us. And most certainly that was the case with my mother, who is an immigrant to America. She would talk about Burma in the most nebulous sort of rose-tinted way, which is to say it was more like Brigadoon than an actual country. You know, I was only told stories about frangipani blossoms and monsoon rains and tea time and English school uniforms and getting mandarin oranges at Christmas time. I mean, they were these beautiful poetic reminiscences, but they weren't real, and they didn't seem to tie my mother or our family on the Burmese side to the past in any real way. It was as if we had shrugged it off and just adopted sort of the lightest of recollections about what we left behind. My father's family didn't really know much about our ancestry. I mean, they had the story that I think a lot of white Americans have, which is, well, we came from Europe and we arrived here, and by dint of hard work and divine providence, we became Americans. And that's just how it went, with no detail offered as to how precisely that all took place.
So what was the turning point for you in making you interested in your ancestors and wanting to do all the research that you did for this book?
I had, in my early 20s and late teens, I had adopted this idea that I was the future face. And that was in large part due to this Time magazine cover from 1993 that proclaimed the future face of America. And it was this racial composite image. And I sort of thought I looked like that. And I felt a sense of kinship with it, insofar as I was also an unscrutable mixed-race person, and maybe that meant I was an avatar from the future. But there was a lack of rootedness to all that, right? I mean, I was like some toucan that had flown in from some part of the world or part of time that had not yet occurred. And I realized in my late 20s and early 30s that I wanted to belong somewhere. I wanted a story to call my own. I wanted to know who my people were. And I think, like a lot of Americans, thought that I could find those people in the past. I could find this mythic tribe of elders who would ground me in a story that was irrefutable, undeniable, that was unique and my own, and it would satisfy all my cravings.
So for a while, when you were thinking about, like, who am I? Who are my ancestors? What does that mean? For a while, you thought you might have Jewish ancestors. What were the clues?
To be clear, my father's family pointed to the Catholic Church as its North Star. Catholic parochial school was how they were educated. They went to church every Sunday. They ate fish on Friday. They had donuts on Sunday. That was my father's identity. That was his tribe. And yet, as I started asking questions, getting more details about the Wagners of Lansing, Iowa, I started hearing these strange asides. Like, my father at one point sitting in the living room said offhandedly, well, your Aunt Susan thinks we're Jewish. And then another cousin said, oh, well, yeah, didn't you know great-grandfather Henry knew Yiddish? And then my aunt had a recollection of one of my granduncles saying, well, I'm just an old Jew. And these stories were spurs, if you will. I mean, they were snags in the family narrative. So I took it upon myself to find out whether the Jewish theory was true.
You were very intrigued by the Jewish theory. You kind of wanted to have some Jewish ancestry. Why?
Who doesn't? No. I mean, I think that especially for someone who's looking for identity, Judaism is one of our civilization's oldest tribes. And all of my Jewish friends had such strong connections to their Jewish roots. There was such a sense of cultural belonging. I was so envious of that, you know. I thought, if I find out that we Wagners are in fact Jewish, it will not only upend the family narrative, which was something that was equally interesting to me, but it'll give me a place to belong. I'm going to start celebrating Passover. I'll go to High Holy Days. You know, it was like this built-in cultural community that I could immediately be part of.
You know, I'm just wondering, is there a growing group of mixed race people who feel a connection and a tribe with each other? because they don't feel like they belong, or other people don't feel that they belong, you know, in the white tribe or the African American tribe or the Asian tribe.
I can't tell you how many mixed race people have come up to me as this book has come out and been in the world and said, I totally identify with this story. And they, a lot of them, hearken back to this moment in the book, which is sort of pivotal. When I was at a diner with my dad, I was 12 years old, and the line cook was looking at me and looking at my father, and my father went to the restroom, and the line cook looked at me after my father had left, and he said, are you adopted? And it was the first time in my life that I realized the way I conceived of myself as this generically American kid who liked television and chocolate chip cookies and Murder, She Wrote, that I conceived of myself as generically American, but not everybody else did. And to some Americans, there was no possible way I could naturally be the daughter of this white American. I had to be from someplace else. And I felt so alienated, and I felt so ashamed, and I was so embarrassed by the question that I sort of like tripped over myself trying to explain that I had an Asian mother.
So let's talk about your mother's side of the family from Burma. And I should say, a lot of people call Burma Myanmar. You're sticking with Burma.
I'm sticking with Burma.
Yeah.
It's a form of, I think it's emotional resistance as much as anything else. But we all called it Burma defiantly when the ruling military junta renamed the country in the 90s as a bid to deflect global attention from the gross violations of human rights that were occurring in Burma. So for a while, even up until the end of the Obama administration, it was still referred to as Burma, sort of as a way of defying what the military junta wanted to do and what it wanted to call the country. Also, I don't think I've ever heard of anyone from Burma being referred to as Myanmarese. Burmese is just how we refer to ourselves.
Right. Okay. So your mother and grandmother fled Burma in the 60s because of a military dictatorship.
Yeah.
What were you hoping to accomplish in going to Burma in your search for your own ancestry?
So I think we think of ancestry in a couple of different ways, or we look at it as an inheritance of blood and, to some degree, soil. So this was my attempt to reconnect with my ancestry by putting foot to ground. And I was hoping that I'd arrive in Rangoon and I would feel this tremor of connection, right? That I would go to the Burmese archives and I could find documents relating to my family history, and it would be proof, hard proof, that we had been here, and that somehow some door would open up in my mind or in my heart, and I could, through that door, find my ancestry and find that tribe, which is, in all honesty, a lot of Americans do that. There is a lot of ancestor tourism, you know, and people will go back to Ireland to touch ground and have a pint in, you know, the same place where their forefathers once did whatever their forefathers did. And there's a real strong idea that we connect to the place once we get there. But for me, with the exception of a very few singular moments, I didn't connect back to Burma. I felt decidedly American in Burma. And all the Burmese people would look at me and say, you must be Thai, right? And I thought, this is just not how it's supposed to go. But then I realized, I think maybe we're too preoccupied with the past and too preoccupied with the idea that nationalism and sense of identity belongs to the soil, to the land, and isn't somehow within ourselves and among each other.
So after doing your best to track your family ancestry through records and archives, you decided to go the DNA route.
Yes.
What is DNA testing supposed to be able to reveal about your family tree?
DNA testing, it's supposed to give you a picture of who your ancestors were, where they existed in the world. And sometimes, depending on which test you take, they'll tell you at what period you may have inherited that DNA. So is this Chinese DNA from the 1600s? Is this Scandinavian DNA from the 1800s? Some of the tests are sophisticated enough, they say, that they can give you a kind of a timestamp on when you inherited what.
And it tells you, like, the proportion of which nationality, well, not nationality, I mean ethnicity, I suppose, is the right word, because
it will.
I don't know where you were.
the ancestry DNA test will give you a sort of fractional racial breakdown. And they'll say, oh, you're 45% Southeast Asian, 22% Scandinavian, and X percent Polynesian. And it's a very tidy little pie chart that ultimately, in theory, adds up to 100%, but it's all kind of percentage breakdowns, down to, in some cases, 0.5% or 1%. And that's kind of where the science gets a little bit hazy, as I learned.
So you got your DNA tested from all three of the best-known services. Why did you want to duplicate like that?
I thought it would be good to just blanket the labs with my DNA and my family's DNA, just because the more you know, the more you know. And even at the outset of this, I had this sense that, well, I would like to compare what the tests say to one another, you know, what the different I'd like to compare what the different results are. I had a sense even at the beginning that maybe the results wouldn't be consistent or that certain tests would find things that other tests didn't. And I also just didn't want to be allegiant to one test in particular, because I didn't know really what separated them.
So you got yourself tested, your mother, your grandmother, and your father.
Correct.
Let's break this down one by one. Was your genealogy consistent with your parents and grandmother's? Did it look like you were all from the same family?
Yeah, only in the most broad sense, right? One DNA test told me I was 14% Scandinavian and that my father was somehow 12 or 13% Scandinavian, which, of course, if you do the math, is impossible unless my mother was part Scandinavian. But the same test didn't say that she was any part Scandinavian. I mean, in the broadest division, yes, the test told me I was basically half Asian and basically half white European. Ish. But then when you got into the sort of origins of those ancestors, that's where they were all over the place. And the same, my father overwhelmingly was white, European. But then when you got into what regions and what countries, the test gave different results. The same for my mother. And that's when the sort of alarm bell started going off. I thought, how can I be 14% Scandinavian on one test and 0% Scandinavian on another? Why is my mom getting so much Mongolian DNA, but nothing that looks like Burmese DNA? How is this? This doesn't make sense. And that's when I began to realize I had no idea what actually goes into a DNA test. I had no idea what data they were using and what kind of references they were using to determine all of this.
So you did some research and talked to some experts on DNA and genetics, and you found out the answer for why your mother's DNA wasn't showing Burmese ancestry. It said Southeast Asian, but not Burmese. Mm-hmm. So what's the answer to that question?
Well, the biggest sort of reveal was that a lot of these DNA test companies, I mean, they're commercial enterprises, right? So they basically purchase or acquire DNA samples based on market demand. If there are a lot of Irish Americans buying ancestry kits, they're going to have a pretty well-developed sample set of Irish DNA that they can use to compare results with. There are not a lot of Burmese people taking DNA tests, in part because they're $100 a piece, in part because Burma has languished basically in an internet blackout for the last 30 years. Burma is just now catching up in terms of information architecture. But needless to say, there's no particular market drive to have very, very, very well-developed Southeast Asian and Burmese DNA. And so the results that were returned were kind of nebulous. And then there are political considerations, like it's hard to get DNA out of certain countries. And so these tests will sort of correct that by looking at, well, what's the nearest country, like Mongolia, that might have some of the same DNA characteristics? I mean, so as a result, you know, on one hand, I was being told I was 14% Scandinavian and some amount Mongolian, and I was inventing these narratives about my ancestry that I think everybody does when they get these results, like, oh, I'm a Viking. I had no idea I was Scottish. Turns out I'm, you know, Polynesian. But actually, if you dig deeper, in some of the cases, that's just because of the realities of the data that these companies have on hand.
So you've done everything you could to try to track down your ancestry. You've traveled to different countries going through archives. You've had your DNA, your father's, your mother's, and grandmother's tested by three different companies. And your conclusion after all of that about your ancestry and the importance of knowing it was?
Spoiler alert. My conclusion was this. I think it's good and important to know who your people were, because I think that makes you a more empathetic person in your life. I mean, I think it just knowing we all come from people who were flawed and made strange decisions and were different than who we thought they were. And I think it's good to reveal those ghosts for who they are. But I think we in this country, and certainly me in my life, we place so much weight on the past and the future, and that is at the expense of the present. And as much as I was looking for this mythical tribe that was going to tell me where I belonged, I was looking to dead men and women, elders I had never known, to shape who I was in the present day, I realized at the end of this that my community is, of course, the men and women that I'm with every day, and that I think as a country, I think as a people, I know personally, I need to reinvest, and we need to reinvest in this present moment. We are at a crossroads in America where there feels like a huge division between us and them. And I think one of the only ways we get through this moment is by understanding that we are fundamentally linked together in this project. And that as much as certain people in our society may want to isolate our bloodlines and build walls and draw borders and, you know, sanitize the past, the future of this species and the inevitable destination is for us to get even closer and to continue to move around the globe together. You know, we're in America for a finite moment in time. Who knows where we'll end up? And I think there's something really beautiful and freeing in that that makes it easier to see our brothers and sisters in the present day.
Alex, it's just been great to talk with you. Thank you so much. Good luck with your book.
Thank you so much, Terry. Thanks for taking an interest.
Alex Wagner's new book is called Future Face.